the beginning of my notes here say I'll be talking practically, but I think you'll agree that Subhuti's talk was definitely not impractical. Lots of very practical ideas in there, actually. What I'm particularly going to do is talk about how to work in metta-bhavana and, let's call it, visualization practice as entry points into the beautiful, using those practices as a way of moving towards the beautiful. To the extent that I feel able to the extent that I can. I think it's obviously my own reflections upon that, and to some extent my own way of practicing. Before that, though, I want to refer to the Pali tradition, to the Theravada tradition, to traditions that aren't actually very well known and probably not that well understood by certainly the contemporary Theravada. But something that Bhante himself has drawn out on more than one occasion. It's metta, abiding in metta, the Brahma-vihara of metta, that leads to beauty. Metta leads to beauty. This is quite traditional. There's a sutta, a very short sutta, I think it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha says that abiding in the Brahma-vihara of metta, so in other words, abiding in all-pervading loving-kindness, leads to a formless liberation, an arupa-vimoksha, simply called the beautiful. I think the status of these arupa liberations, these formless liberations, I think they're generally regarded as mundane, but it might be another one of these traditions that needs a bit of reflection upon. But anyway, there is this sutta where the Buddha makes it clear that dwelling in metta leads to a formless liberation called the beautiful, shubha, pure beauty. And perhaps this is at the back of, well, it certainly is at the back of Bhante's mind, because he references it in various expositions that he's given, tucked away in seminars, regarding the relationship between beauty and metta. Let's call it between love and beauty. And indeed, in relation to wisdom as well. In one place, Bhante says, the aim of metta, the aim of loving kindness, the end of the metta-bhavana, what you're aiming for is a sort of, as he puts it, free-floating loving kindness. Free-floating loving kindness. It's not you doing the loving kindness to all beings. In a sense, there's no one doing it and no one receiving it. There is just loving kindness. There is just metta, freely floating, as he puts it. He says, you're just there. There's just love. And you just allow it, as it were, to just naturally turn its to attention to, as it were, whoever. He's obviously, I get the sense he's talking from experience, and it's might be something quite hard to talk about. But the aim, very definitely, is this free-floating loving-kindness. He references this a bit in the talk he gives on Dada Rinpoche's motto, where he talks about radiate love. Towards the end of the discussion of radiate love, he talks just about this free-floating loving-kindness. It's interesting as well, the end of the Karaniya Metta Sutta, towards the end of the Karaniya Metta Sutta, is interesting. You have that line which goes, standing or moving, sitting or lying down, wield this blessing power of mindfulness of boundless love. That's my own translation. Wield this blessing power. Etang sating aditeya. Aditeya is the Pali for adhisthana, which suggests to me that it's not so much you going around doing metta, it's more metta is flowing through you, so to speak. That's the aim, and that is the Brahma-vihara of metta. So the question is how? How do we reach this free-floating loving-kindness? which is also said to be an experience of beauty. That's the same thing, the formless liberation called the beautiful. It's the same. How do we go about this? So I'm going to go through each of the stages of the metta bhavana and see how we might move towards, well, in the end, seeing everybody and everything as beautiful, seeing it with the eye of loving kindness. These are suggestions, these are things coming from my own, to some extent, experience or reflections that I like to use myself. You might have other ways into doing this. But the important thing is to bring beauty into metta, into our metta practice. The first thing I'd like to suggest is, perhaps I don't know if this is something that that's talked about very much. Before the metta bhavana, before we actually go into the stages, we simply recollect the qualities of love. If you like, the beauty of metta. There is a tradition that before you meditate on a particular virtue or quality, before you develop a particular virtue or quality, you recollect the glory of those, of the qualities that you're trying to develop. You recollect, in this case, the qualities of metta, in whatever way, if you like. I remember, one of the best expositions I've come across of what love really is Bhante's discussion of love in the Ten Pillars of Buddhism, where he quotes Shelley, where there's those lines like, love is a going out of ourselves, imagining the beautiful in another, in all others. A bit later on he talks about the love, which is the positive counterpart of the first precept, as being, it's no mere flabby sentiment, but a vigorous expression of imaginative identification with others. And so much so that love isn't a good word for it. Neither is maitri or metta a good word for it. He says if it's love at all, it's a cherishing, maturing and protective love, which has the same effect on the human being as the sun has on plants. Perhaps we might recollect the Buddha saying that the love that we're developing in metta bhavana for all beings is like the mother's love for her only child, which is an astonishing thing to contemplate. I've mentioned these things. They were the immediate things I thought of when I was thinking about this talk. If I'm bringing to mind what I'm trying to do in metta, that, as Subhuti puts it, gets my juices flowing, it's things like this. It's expressions like this. It makes love attractive. It makes metta attractive to me, no matter what difficulties I might pass through in the metta bhavana. If I can bring to mind what the end point is and see its loveliness, I want to do it. I want to pass through the fires, so to speak, of the metta bhavana. So find a way to make metta, the end of metta, if you like, if there is indeed an end, attractive to you, beautiful to you. Then there's the first stage of the metta, which I know for many people can be a very difficult stage, even problematic stage. How do we look for the beauty in this stage of the practice? That's real, if you like, that's not contrived, you know, that looking at myself, oh, that's beautiful and that's beautiful and, you know, that bit of my body's beautiful or whatever it is. I don't think it's really about that. One of the things that I do, and it's based on this traditional reflection on the preciousness of human life. What's very important for me in this, whatever I'm feeling, whatever's happening to me, whatever, in a sense, my attitude is, it's the pleasure of being alive that becomes very important. If you like, the energy of being alive. that I do possess this very, very precious human existence, and even just getting down to some basic responses, the pleasure of breathing, the pleasure of sensing, the pleasure of thinking, just that very simple pleasure. Of course, there's more to it than that. Not only do I have a precious human life, I have a charya, I have a dharmacharya, I'm a dharmacharya, I'm a dharmachari. I'm living a life, I have meaning in my life, I have a path, and so on. You know, there are all these reflections that you get in the tradition. I'm not suggesting doing all of them, but I have a path, I have a meaningful life, I have very good friends. And it's not just about valuing that, or even appreciating. I mean, appreciating, the word appreciation is a word that Bhante uses quite a bit in relation to beauty and metta. I think, for me, one of the things that I need to contact is something like celebration. Something like celebration, just celebrating what I have already. I was very struck going through the endlessly fascinating cry, Bhante's commentary on the Bodhicharyavatara, and he, I think it's Marian Matic in his commentary, uses the expression thanksgiving in describing Shantideva's response to the arising of the bodhicitta. There's this expression of thanksgiving. He doesn't just use the word gratitude, but thanksgiving, celebrating, rejoicing in, wondering at what he has. And I think that's one of the things I'm looking for in the first stage of the metta bhavana, actually recognizing the wealth that I already possess. And like I say, I think this is something that we could do with doing a lot more of, you know, in this culture, which seems to just encourage lack and a consciousness of lack and, you know, and what's wrong and so on and so forth. That word charya, by the way, just to say, it's a word that Bhante has taken up at various times in his talks, talking about the original word for the spiritual life is brahmacharya, then there's dharmacharya, then there's bodhicharya, which is the bodhisattva's life. But then he mentions this rather interesting anubhogacharya, the faring, the living, the path of supreme pleasure, supreme enjoyment. That's what happens when you are, presumably, when you're irreversible. So there's this sense of really living a life of pleasure. But we can start. We start by really looking at what we have, what's there in our life. I've been looking at some of the Mahasiddha material recently, and their typical mode of communication, the early tantrics, is the Charyagiti, the songs of the life. And they're all songs of tremendous, well, not just inspiration, but expressions of ecstasy at the beauty and the pleasure of their lives, the life that they're living. So that's some thoughts about the first stage. The second stage, the good friend, should of course be the easiest part of the meditation. Bhante was saying in one seminar that metta is all inclusive. It doesn't leave anybody out, but you've got to trick yourself into doing that. You trick yourself into it by having a good friend in your meditation. Bringing them to mind. And again, if it's a good friend, well, in a way you don't have to do anything. Where there is friendship, there is love. And where there is love, there is beauty. You'll find your friend attractive. Maybe even physically attractive, or attractive in other ways. I know in one place that Bhante says, if you're if you have a good friend who's physically attractive, so much the better. So much the better. That just adds to things. So you just have them there. You sort of don't, as I say, really need to do anything. You just let the love be there. One of the things about bhavana is that you just give your attention to the quality that's already there. So if there's it doesn't matter what the level of love is, it's just sort of low-level friendliness, you just give that attention. You just make that central, and it will grow. It will develop. But you're developing love, of course, for their sake. This is something that you're not just sort of getting off on the fact that they're a good friend. That might be that you get pleasure from. That might be a beginning, but you're developing love for their sake. The good friend is not for your use and utility. You're seeing them more and more as a person. You are very aware of your own personhood. We are very aware of our own personhood. That's in a way what we're doing in the first stage. We're really loving our sense of being alive, of breathing and so on. Looking for beauty in a good friend means being delighted by them. We like what we see in our friend. We like their spiritual beauty. And we look for that. You know, if they find them physically beautiful as well, that's good. But we look for that. We dwell on that. We take delight in it. We take delight in their quality. Their quality. Their quality. Their actual quality. We're even transported by it. I think it's really well worth letting yourself go, if you can, in the second stage of the practice, with all of the metta bhavana. Just really let yourself go. Don't hold back. Sometimes people worry about things like prema, you know, the near enemy of metta, attached love, exclusive love. But you're going to do the other stages later on, so you don't need to worry about that. You know, in one place, Bhante says that metta is just prema made boundless. That's really all it is. So that's something on the second stage. The third stage. So here we have somebody that, you know, where there's indifference. So what do we do? What can we do where there's absolutely nothing going on in relation to that neutral person? And of course, what do we do in the fourth stage where there's somebody who we have real hatred for? I think one of the things that I find very important in the metta bhavana is that I need to never move away from, or to always need to stay in touch with, the pleasure and the delight, yes indeed, the beauty of the earlier stages. They must never be forgotten in the metta bhavana. I don't think it's a good idea to spend ages in a stage where you're just resenting the other person. I don't think there's any virtue in that. Okay, you can look at it and open it up, but just to sort of try and grind out a metta bhavana, spending, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes on the fourth stage and feeling thoroughly fed up is a good idea. You need to keep referring back all the time to that absorption in the delight of the earlier stages. And you consider, in this case, the neutral person from that state of delight that you've experienced in the stages beforehand. And again, particularly important here is that imaginative identification. You need to look for that humanness, that human quality in them. You have it, you have that human quality, that human life, that feeling of life. You want to live, you want to feel secure, you want to feel safe and protective, you want to be treated well, you want to be treated with courtesy and respect, you want to be loved. they are exactly the same. They are no different from you. That person that you know nothing about, you don't need to know any information about them to know that they actually want to be treated in the same way that you want to be treated. Their fundamental attitude to life, if you like, is exactly the same. And in this way, you start to even try and feel, if you like, from, wrote down, their life energy that you're feeling in yourself, that they, that life in them that they share with you. As I say, you don't need any information about that person to love them. Not really. You just need to imagine, if you like, their desires, their aspirations, because you have them. And that way you're exactly the same. Sangadeva will remember that back in the day, in the 1980s, when we worked in the restaurant, very successful vegetarian restaurant that we had in Croydon, the Croydon Buddhist Centre called Hockness, we had somebody who used to come regularly to the restaurant, who we called the customer, capital T, capital C, the customer. He was, you must remember the customer, of course you do. And he worked in one of the offices, I think he was a civil servant, and he worked in one of the offices in Croydon. And he came every day for his lunch, which was, I think, invariably, was it jacket potato and quiche? Yeah, I think that was, and salad, that jacket potato, quiche and salad, that was his standard. And the customer, we all came to love. We all came to love the customer. I don't even know, none of us knew his name. He was a very, I mean, he was a sort of classic person for the third stage of the Metta-bhavana. He was very, there wasn't any particular expression. He always seemed to wear grey. But he was very loyal to us. And I think all of us put him in the third stage. And we did actually grow to love him. And when we heard that he hadn't been in for a while, and we asked one of his colleagues what had happened, and she told us that he'd had a heart attack. We sent flowers. We sent flowers. He'd become so important to us. And apparently he went round the office telling everybody what we'd done. So I would say he sort of became beautiful to us, didn't he? He wasn't a beautiful man or anything like that, but we grew to love this man. It's curious how this works in the practice of giving somebody attention. In a way, I mean, perhaps it is to do with imagination as well, in the sense of, I was on a train with Subhuti coming from my screen, and there was a lad sitting opposite us, and Subhuti noticed him and was sort of wondering, you know, what this man was, what he did, and so on and so forth. Subhuti's imagination was working. He didn't do that while he was sitting opposite us. It was after he got off. But maybe that's what we need to do if we're going to endow the customer, the neutral person, with, you know, beauty, if you like, if we're going to love them. So in stage four, we're searching for beauty in the enemy, the person we have ill will towards. Notice this thing, this language that's come in, that we call them the difficult person, as though it's their problem, they're a difficult person. The actual fact is, we have ill will towards them. That's the issue. The difficulty is with us, however they are, as it were. So there's somebody towards whom we have ill will, we're resentful towards them, we hold a grudge against them, maybe. And because of that, perhaps we regard them as ugly, or impure, or whatever it is. So what to do? What to do in this stage of the practice? Sometimes we can have somebody in the fourth stage year after year after year. Sometimes it might be, you know, somebody we usually get on with, but there's been misunderstandings, and even then it can be really difficult. And, you know, it happens within our own spiritual community, long-standing, you know, resentments between people. I had an interesting experience on solitary retreat some years ago, where I had somebody in the fourth stage, an order member in the fourth stage. And it was one of those where I was really wrestling again and again with the fourth stage. I was trying everything. I was going through their qualities. I was looking at the problems of my aversion and so on and so forth. Nothing seemed to be able to shift this grudge. And I was looking through living with kindness. And Bhante said something like, I can't remember his exact words, but it was something along the lines of, you don't do the fourth stage of the metta bhavana to overcome your ill will for your sake. You're developing metta because they are a human being. You're developing metta because they are a human being. You develop love for them. And suddenly, maybe I was ready for those words, there was a shift. I realized that my aversion and resentment was because I wanted something from that person that I was resenting. I wanted recognition or appreciation, acknowledgement, whatever it was. And I thought, why? I wanted to beat them to be different from what they actually are. And I thought, why? Why should they be that for me? And suddenly I could just enjoy their genius, their unique quality, their energy, their being. And the aversion just vanished. I could just take delight in them. Came to mind at that time was the Bhante's revisioning of the first precept. I don't know if you've come across Bhante's tantric version of the five precepts. And the first is, do not obstruct the energy of any other person. Do not obstruct the energy of any other person. And I think what I was doing in relation to that person was sort of obstructing them by not allowing them, at least in my own mind, to just be themselves in the best sense. And of course, that was obstructing me. So I was loving that energy, if you like, that beautiful energy that that person had. It was, in a way, fairly easy, a bit pathetic that I got into this tangle with this particular person, because they're a fine person who'd done me, actually, and done me no wrong. Of course, it's much, much harder with someone who's actively doing you harm or done you harm. But it's the same in principle. Now, Shantideva, I was completely astonished recently when I was studying Kshanti Paramita, where Shantideva says enemies must be bodhisattvas and Buddhas. They must be. They can't be anything else. Bodhisattvas and Buddhas in all their glory, they have to be that because they are teaching you love. So rejoice. Rejoice in them. Praise them. Love them. That's the language he uses. There can't be anything else. I think Vimalakirti says much the same thing, where he says all the maras that tempt the bodhisattva must be bodhisattvas, because it's only bodhisattvas that can tempt another bodhisattva. It'd be impossible for a mara to do it. So let's pretend we're bodhisattvas. So, as I said, throughout the metta bhavana, if these different things that I've suggested in these sages aren't working, return to the contemplation, the easy contemplation of the beauty of metta. Return to delighting, particularly in your friend, maybe in yourself. Don't stay in a negative and resentful state. Okay, you might have to sort of sit there and be equanimous in relation to it, but don't feed it. That's just going to lead to, well, to resentment and ugliness. Then the fifth stage. In the fifth stage, there is this beginning of the stage, which Bhante said is very, very important, the equalizing of the metta to all the four people in the meditation. Making them the same, realizing the sameness of self, good friend, neutral person, enemy, to the point of dissolving all of those labels. The notion of self, good friend, neutral person and enemy dissolves. It's said that it's important to spend a long time dwelling in this, dwelling in this. It's as if you're being asked to be absorbed in metta, and you just keep these four, keep either bringing one to mind, then another to mind, or just holding them in your mind until such point as you are absorbed. They actually use the word samadhi. Buddha Ghosha uses the word samadhi here. You're completely absorbed in the love, in the loving kindness. It's a kind of integration going on. And interestingly, in a discussion in another seminar, Bhante talks about this in relation to insight. This stage of metta where you realize the sameness of self and other. He said this is an experience of selflessness. You're losing your sense of self. And he says this is insight. You might not be thinking in terms of insight, but if you're so absorbed in love that these labels are dissolving, in actual fact, insight is opening up. So, and the more absorbed you can be in this stage of the practice, the more there's the ease of the expansion of loving kindness. You know all the different ways of expanding loving kindness, but I think the way I try to do it these days is just gently letting the love open out in whatever way, opening up to this free-floating loving kindness, just allowing anybody to come into consciousness and to let the love, as it were, shine on them. If we've been successful in the stages, if we've stripped the mind of utility, of using others, of looking at others in terms of their use, if we have been loving them as persons, as they are in themselves, as living people, living beings, perhaps this is the link between metta and the experience of beauty. There's this dropping of the using of others. There's this more aesthetic appreciation, and then beauty, even this sort of formless beauty, can begin to open up. I mean, in one of the seminars, I think you've got it, Bhante says, if you're in a good mood, you see everybody as beautiful. He just puts it like that. So just sitting then at the end of metta becomes more a dwelling in and opening up to this pure, formless, all-pervading beauty. And it's intensely pleasurable. I think that whenever there's a sort of expansion, a kind of a dropping of that contraction, whenever one feels oneself expanding, that is so pleasurable. It's so lovely, that sense. I don't know why it works like that, but it just does. It just is. And it is interesting in relation to the discussion of beauty that, you know, the Buddha does say, Nibbanam Paramang Sukhang, Nirvana is the supreme bliss. In one place in the Pali text, just staying with this formless liberation called the beautiful, in one place in the Pali text, the liberation called the beautiful opens up when you say in deep meditation, Subhahati, Subhahati, oh beautiful, oh beautiful. I don't know whether this is because some monk or yogi did it, you know, just suddenly said, Subhahati, or whether it's actually a mantra. You just say, Subhahati. And I've been doing it in meditation at the end of metta and before my sadhana. I just say, Subhahati, and just see what happens, and just open up to the beautiful. No need to go into the results, it's too early to say. But let's talk about this formless liberation called the beautiful, this pure beauty. Let's see where it might lead. And in one place, it can lead to vision. It can lead to the Buddha and the Bodhisattva. And in one of your handouts, there's a discussion of this. I won't read it because I'm a bit conscious of time. But basically what Bhante is saying, this is in answer to a question on a retreat where somebody said, why is metta bhavana so important for the preparation for visualization practice? And Bhante made this connection between metta leading to this state of formless beauty, this strong emotional response. And then he describes what happens, in a sense, in visualization, is that that formless beauty sort of condenses or perhaps even crystallizes into a form. Out of that formless beauty, there's a form of the Buddha or Bodhisattva. And he says it's extremely important in, well, he says, first of all, visualization practice is not just about getting an eidetic image. It's not about seeing something coldly, like looking at a picture on the wall or something like that. If it's going to be a means to liberation, you need to see the form of the Buddha or Bodhisattva as intensely beautiful. He even uses the word fascination. He uses the word fascination. He said, if you're fascinated, you're held there. You're held by the unconditioned. You're held by this image of the unconditioned. He even seems to be saying in these extracts that the intensity of feeling, the strength of feeling for the beauty of the form of the Buddha or Bodhisattva, that is what's going to give you insight. That's the way it's that's what's going to give you insight in a visualization practice. It doesn't really say anything in this section to do with, you know, reflecting on form and emptiness and things like that. I'm not saying that's unimportant. It's the intensity of the response to the beauty of the form. You know, and you know very well that in sometimes in the literature, in some of the best literature, not the formulaic literature, when, you know, a devotee describes the beauty of the Buddha or Bodhisattva, well, it is like a love song. It's like a love song. I mean, I can think of Mandarava singing to Padmasambhava in The Life and Liberation of Padmasambhava. She says, the healing power of love. And then describes all of his, you know, his eyes and his glossy black hair and the colour of his skin and, you know, the pinky quality of it. It just goes through it, and it's, we might not go along with all the aesthetics of Indo-Tibetan aesthetics, but you can see what's going on. There's this fascination with the Buddha form, the Bodhisattva form, and it's interesting that the Indian tantric term for what's generally called the Yidam is the Ishta Devatar. Ishta, I was told by a Sanskrit scholar, means greatly desired, intensely desired. It's the intensely desired divine form that you're responding to. It's not just an idea, it's not simply just appreciation. There's this intensity of response, the strength of emotional response. But then in another seminar, Bhante looks at it kind of the other way as well, where he says, well, he talks about your perception of Shubha going beyond a particular form or embodiment. You no longer see Avalokiteshvara or Manjushri or the Buddha or who or whatever, but you are still perceiving Shubha, though paradoxically a formless Shubha. You've left behind all specific forms. If you are asked if it is red, yellow or green, or square or round, male or female, you couldn't say. But you would be perfectly certain that it is still the experience of Shubha. In fact, it is more Shubha than ever. So you can approach it both ways. In a way, you're going in and out of form with these practices. You have the metta, which the form of the metta that leads to an experience of formless beauty. Then the Buddha or Bodhisattva, as it were, condenses. You meditate on that, and then you open up to formless beauty again. Perhaps this also needs us. Maybe we need to, you know, rethink. I think that's what Subhuti was sort of get our notions of shunyata. In relation, in the light of these passages, you know, and what the blue, the significance of the blue sky really is, and what's really going on. Perhaps changing the metaphor a bit. You know, there's that great medieval tantric Advaivadra has this wonderful saying that the form of the deity is an explosion of shunyata. The form of the deity is an explosion of shunyata. It's not just a kind of vacant space in which you see a pretty picture and you sort of nut out form and emptiness. No, it's beauty. It's beauty. It's the emergence of beauty, emergence from formless beauty into a really captivating, fascinating form, dissolving again away into formless beauty. But we'll stay with practicalities, and this afternoon we're going to do a metta bhavana, and we'll see if we can't practice, put into practice some of this.